la production de l'équité. C'est le poète acadien Hermé-Gilles Chiasson qui dit que les textes, les œuvres, les mots sont comme des bouteilles à la mer qu'on recouvre et qu'on ouvre à sa convenance et qu'on redécouvre à chaque fois. C'est un peu l'occasion aujourd'hui pour nous tous de redécouvrir et de parler de ce que Rod a fait pour nous. Mais aussi, c'est un peu rassurant de savoir qu'un des textes qui m'appartient de présenter aujourd'hui dit que « there's no such thing as the, and questions the concept of objectivity ». And I have to say, as Harry Arthur said, we each have our own views about what Rod says to us, and every time that we read a text, I think we discover it in a different way. Alors, je vais commencer tout de suite en décrivant un peu ce que je retiens des textes qui devaient être lus pour la session. Par la suite, parce que mon devoir était de les résumer, je vais faire de mon possible pour les résumer de façon le plus adéquate possible et laisser la parole à mes collègues là, pour qu'ils aient l'occasion de réfléchir sur ce que ces textes-là ont voulu dire pour eux, pour leur développement et aussi pour l'avenir de l'enseignement et de la production du droit. Chaque être humain a la capacité et la responsabilité de produire l'équité. Ce n'est pas tant dans la reproduction des règles que se vit l'équité, mais dans une reconnaissance constante des rapports sains, exempts d'exploitation, qui doivent exister entre personnes. Le droit ne produit pas nécessairement l'équité, mais il peut libérer la capacité des individus et des communautés de le faire et d'agir justement, d'agir moralement. Les institutions que les humains créent pour produire l'équité ou pour vivre plus équitablement peuvent être facilement manipulés. Une attention constante doit être portée à la façon dont ils sont installés pour qu'ils puissent rappeler les responsabilités aux êtres humains et créer pour eux la possibilité d'être justes et exiger d'eux qu'ils remplissent leurs responsabilités et leur imposent une imputabilité. Ce n'est pas tant le droit formel qui n'est pas pertinent à l'équité, mais simplement le droit n'est pas en soi porteur et peut si facilement masquer l'inéquité. L'équité ne se produit pas, ne se vit pas dans l'abstrait, mais dans le concret des rapports humains. Elle est fragile, elle est dynamique et elle se vit et se reproduit dans le quotidien par une myriade d'interactions interpersonnelles. Et c'est ça le droit vivant. Selon moi, c'est un peu ce que Rod m'a enseigné au fil des années. In the texts that are the subject of this part, I think the production of fairness is sought from all actors, and that's what I'm going to try to focus on. The first text was Restoring Dignity, Responding to Child Abuse in Canadian Institution, the first report of the Law Commission. Restoring Dignity was the breathtaking, groundbreaking report that the Law Commission produced in 2000. Many people who contributed to the report are in the room. And they were inspired by the great leadership of Rod, who had reinvented law reform in that capacity. The subject was the responsibilities of current Canadian society for the racist policies of the past, the residential schools. It demanded a contextual approach to the production of fairness. How can you be fair in responding to such widespread, profound wounds in the power relationship between Aboriginal people and Canada? How can you be fair in trying to give a voice to the hurt and wounded children of the past? By taking and embracing responsibility, will answer Rod MacDonald. The report is well known for its thoughtful and comprehensive approach. It suggests that everyone in Canada bears a responsibility to help in the healing, and that many institutions can produce fairness and must produce fairness in this context. Fairness is produced by a wide array of actors, not only governments, but the judiciary, the law society, the university, and the Canadian public more generally. C'est cette dimension de l'éclatement des responsabilités pour la production de l'équité qui retient souvent l'attention. Taking responsibility is also in this context about change, about mobilizing for change, about future action and prevention. Moving beyond government as the target of law reform demands and demanding more of all institutions were key aspects of the report that were transformative in a way in the law reform field. To produce fairness in this context demanded more than a few legal pronouncements, but rather a radical transformation of their very approach that Canada, Canadians, and many institutions had undertaken toward the issue. I think that this is the attention to the context, to the roles of this multiplicity of actors, to the fundamental sharing of responsibility that had to occur, that indeed created the possibility for this report to speak the way it did and to have the impact that it did, since eventually the government did at least apologize on behalf of all Canadians. The second text is Parameters of Politics and Judicial Appointment, another 10 years later, another law reform agenda for La Commission Bastarache on Judicial Appointment. The paper confronts directly the idea of neutrality, subjectivity, objectivity, and the role of politics, positive and negative, big P, small p, in choosing the powerful actors that are the judges. This is about institutional design designed to produce fairness. In the part on is it possible to discipline subjective judgment about judicial appointment, we are invited to reflect on the following. So it's the optimist, but not quite. Here is the more realist rod. There's no perfect system. No system, however good, always functions perfectly. Nevertheless, we should try to minimize the manipulation or gaming that goes on and invest in transparency and accountability. Making our subjectivity clearer, identifying it, speaking about it, not hiding it or masking it under legal pronouncement will enhance fairness. And to me, this message about producing fairness is also producing truth has been central to, I think, what I see in Rod. So the report recognizes the subtle ways in which judges can be influenced, politicized in the wrong ways. It is, again, a broad approach that recognizes the role of context, the dynamic nature of interactions, the wisdom about human nature, and the frailties of all of our attempts in securing fairness that I think speaks in this report. The recommendations, again, are far-ranging and confronts the silences of the current processes, and I think that will be one aspect that I'd like to come back about. It does look very profoundly as the dynamics that exist in the processes that make people act justly or not so justly. Lessons in everyday law that we've spoke about already, I won't talk as much about, is the nobility of everyday law that is celebrated. Dans ce livre extraordinaire, le professeur MacDonald reprend les chroniques mensuelles qu'il faisait à la Commission pour expliquer avec force anecdotes, petites histoires, certains aspects fondamentaux et de la philosophie de notre droit. Pourquoi a-t-on un processus législatif? Qu'est-ce qui est juste et pour qui? C'est un peu les fables de La Fontaine. C'est des leçons de choses, une approche pédagogique qui engage le lecteur dans l'histoire pour le faire réfléchir. Because fairness is within everybody's reach, because it can be done and must be experienced at the day-to-day level, the book speaks to the tensions in the hierarchy of modes of speech in speaking about law, in owning legal knowledge, in distributing it, in owning it, in not wanting to share it. In my view, there's something so wonderful in this, in explaining Fuller with short histories of Madeleine and Aidan's family holidays that have always continued to impress all of us. So the idea of using a language that could reach us all in the most and engage us at the core level was, I think, what has been so powerful about this. Perspective on personal relationships. This, I think I have to say, was the opening address at the Conference of Domestic Partnership in Queen's University. This was a radical approach to kind of testing legal language and categories with a view of assessing whether they liberate people and allow them to be fair or, on the contrary, force them in unhealthy choices, highlights and reinforces certain relationships and not others, does not give enough people the ability to be who they are. Give me couple minutes to explain the context of this paper. The Law Commission was engaged in a study of law and relationships, personal, social, economic, and governance relationship as a way to avoid the definitional boundaries and limitations of doing family law, criminal law, commercial law, and public law. The approach was designed to force us to question the way in which family law evokes a certain grouping of people and ignores others. Questionings are reflexes that always come from using categories. At the time, gay marriage was still being debated, and certainly the idea of engaging in a conversation that would posit that marriage had been overused by the legislature as a proxy to capture psychological or economic independence was controversial. The debate for the LGBT community was that we should not be asking questions about marriage, but indeed let gays and lesbians in it. As someone in the conference said, before reorganizing the furniture in the house of marriage, let us in, you know. So, but the paper is about something different. It's about to invite people to think outside the box about the nature of personal relationship, the role of the state in structuring, aligning, supporting, or being neutral toward personal choices of citizens. Did the law allow people, did it help people in achieving fairness in being non-exploitative in all of their personal relationships with their helpers, with their caretakers, independently of all their sexual intimacy? In a way, I think Rod, as he always does, was questioning whether our legal imagination had imprisoned our capacity to produce fairness. Again, I think the clarification aspect of this report was important. It's about saying it as it is, identifying the range of possibilities that exist for all of us, and identifying well what does and is not happening. A theory of procedural fairness, and this is the last one. Dans cet article de 1981, Rod développe sa théorie. Alors, c'est de 1981. Développe sa théorie de la justice procédurale, un précurseur un peu de certaines des idées que j'ai exposées ici. So it says it's not enough to just to follow the rules to be fair. A narrowly defined decontextualized approach to decision making, to process participation, or to accountability leads to masking unfairness, leads to untruths being legitimized. Je lis ce texte où Rod explique que les principes de la justice procédurale doivent viser la qualité de la participation des personnes affectées et deuxièmement le processus de raisonnement, l'explication qui est donnée pour expliquer les résultats d'un processus décisionnel. Ces deux éléments, selon moi, expliquent bien la production de l'équité dont on parle. Il s'agit de permettre aux personnes de bien se comprendre, d'avoir la chance d'être équitable, de reconnaître les rapports de pouvoir qui existent entre elles, et de porter un jugement et d'agir moralement, et d'être transparent, de bien identifier ce qui se passe et de ne pas se cacher derrière le droit pour masquer un manque de courage, une discrimination, un jugement mesquin ou, évidemment, un rapport de pouvoir qui est renforcé. How has this influenced my work? I think Rod, for me, was a liberation theorist, a liberation terrorist sometimes, to insist on desire for honesty and inquiry, throughout, to identifying all factors, the religious, the moral, the physical, the power dynamics, the sociological, the psychological, to get a truer picture of what really is going on was implicit in the work and was such a challenge. To recognize with an optimism that I share the power of human and to at all times, at the margins, in the right circumstances, do the right thing and to be engaged in the production of fairness was an important aspect to me. To insist on institutions and community that they should be self-reflective, that they should offer transparency, honesty, self-learning, that worry all the time about their own capacity to mask the production of unfairness and to aim to construct and reconstruct themselves with this worry always in their mind. This is what Rod has given to me. The future of the work is certainly, I think, to continue to engage widely in this spirit of inquiry, to really continue to do the search for truth as an element of the search for fairness. In administrative and policy design, there's so many wisdom in this, about try to ensure that organizations are self-reflective and do see within themselves the power creations that they do. Outside of paying lip service to self-reflection, how do we use and design mechanisms of evaluation that speak truly to the issues of engaging in moral agency? Do we study the silences of the law, the silences that oppress and that undermine fundamentally the production of fairness? Si la production d'équité est davantage que le simple respect des règles de droit, si elle est après tout la recherche de la vérité, comment refléter cette conception si riche de nos aspirations dans toute notre compréhension du droit, de son enseignement et de sa pratique et de sa production? Merci beaucoup.
There is never enough time. It is always tempting to think about what we would do if we had more. And so I begin my contribution, entitled Law 8 Days a Week, by thinking aloud about what I could have done had I had more time. Based on the materials for this panel on producing fairness, I could have written an essay on Rod MacDonald's vision of dignity and its centrality in assessing the responsiveness of state and non-state law to shared commitments and multiple identities. I could have focused on Rod MacDonald's insistence on listening, sharing, and finding words and actions that foster collaboration, whether in projects of rethinking close personal relationships, processes of selecting judges, supporting responsible choices, or identifying the enterprise of law across sites of institution building. But it was a busy week, and I just didn't have time. So I arrived today with my agenda in hand, filled with reminders of how I have filled my hours and days. On Saturday, I picked up a printed booklet of photo essays prepared by Canadian and Israeli law students in my summer seminar entitled Socioeconomic Justice, Children at Play. Course participants explored ways in which children's experiences enrich understanding and practice related to socioeconomic fairness, and socioeconomic context shapes the needs, claims, and responsibilities of young people. We examined the potential and perils of the language of individual rights on one hand, and of the language of protection on the other. While both capture something important about human dignity and social values, both can be misleading. Children themselves, just like the Boy Scouts in Rod MacDonald's essay on social ordering in Lessons of Everyday Law, or the kids he quotes who protest, "It's not fair, he hit me first," teach us important lessons as jurists. The photo essays show children as the future for Bedouin families and villages, as wielders of toy guns in a market, or as vendors for their family businesses, as observers, negotiators, critics, and artists. They are never simple victims, sole claimants, or self-assured actors. As Restoring Dignity, the Law Commission's report on responses to institutional child abuse reminds us, how we treat our children and how we allow them to be treated reveals much about ourselves and about our values as a society. By following children, law students can explore the paths they will take as jurists, as dreamers and drafters, translators and teachers, storytellers, advocates, consultants, and companions. On Sunday, I worked on a report on Integration Week, the first full week of learning law for McGill's entering students in September of 2013. For 5 days, all first-year law students and first-year law professors engaged in a sustained conversation about law's interaction with past, present, and future, about the doors that beckon before the law, about the projects that call upon jurists to connect human needs, human voices, human actions, and human institutions. One of the days of that integration week centered on residential schools. As an introduction to studying law in Canada, to understanding roles and responsibilities and responses, to thinking about sites and structures for restoring dignity to individuals, families, communities, and entire societies. To start the day, students heard excerpts from accounts given by survivors of residential school, read aloud by upper-year students situated all around this moot court, and were thus invited to pay attention to the intersection of empathy and analysis, narrative and argument. At the same time, they began that day, and indeed their entire legal education, with Rod McDonald's voice in their heads, the voice behind the Law Commission recommendations that labeled the perspective of survivors of institutional child abuse central to the effectiveness of response, that reminded us that government does not have the monopoly on meaningful redress, that combined acknowledgement, accountability, memory, and public awareness. On Monday, I taught a class of extra-contractual obligations. This week, we focused on relational loss, the damage suffered by victims par ricochet, understood as secondary, because their loss stems from the injury or death of someone else. As we see, that someone else is usually a loved one, and the private law has a range of specific mechanisms for recognizing and underscoring particular relationships. Over a decade ago, I wrote a report for the Law Commission of Canada on the picture of relationships that count in the private law of civil wrongs. Understandably reluctant to turn grief into a fully compensable harm, private law quietly plays its part in supporting only some horizontal and vertical human relationships, and thus becomes one of the many places to pay attention to the questions posed by Rod McDonald. Are there things that happen in relationships that we see as socially beneficial, such that we should actually orient our legal regulatory regimes to promote relationships rather than just targeting individuals? What are the dominant socio-cultural religious structures that articulate and organize the conceptual frame for a whole series of social and legal policies? On Tuesday, I taught my seminar in legal education, a seminar I am teaching for the first time, in the syllabus of which I have noted my debt to Rod McDonald, its longtime professor, and the materials of which open with Rod McDonald's academic questions and close with Harry Arthur's The Future of Legal Education, Three Visions and a Prediction. Participants in the course discuss the contours of legal education, the law faculty's place in the university, the connection between learning law and preparing for a life as a jurist, the roles of law teachers, scholars, and deans. Recently, I used the example of teaching Paul's graph to provoke a discussion of what first-year students learn and how. One of the doctoral candidates in the seminar asked, "Do you teach tort law to your students, or instead how to think like lawyers?" As Rod might say, it was a good teaching and learning moment. Both, all of the time, is the obvious answer, each through the other. The question invites a discussion of how students learn not just how to think like lawyers, but to listen and do and create and team build and express appropriate humility like lawyers. How we help them do that as their teachers is crucial. How do we ensure that students, as Rod McDonald asked of judges, retain the precious idealism of youth, those moments of wide-eyed wonderment that impel the constant discovery and rediscovery of self? On Wednesday, I helped sort through proposals for the upcoming annual meeting of the Canadian Association of Law Teachers. The theme of the conference, designed by those of us entrusted with guidance of the association this year, is Open Doors, Teaching and Learning Law for Justice. It invites reflection on faculties of law as important sites for thinking about justice and fairness, regulation and governance, nourishing of life projects, law as what Rod McDonald says in A Theory of Procedural Fairness is a natural and creative phenomenon arising from human conduct. On the agenda is a discussion of the future of the Association of Canadian Law Teachers itself. Rod McDonald's paramètre of politics, focused on the process of choosing judges, holds important lessons. So does, sometimes it's better just to fix the dock, and who do you think you are anyway? Who do we think we are as teachers of law? Among our many identities that count, do we include members of a countrywide collective with shared objectives and priorities? In what ways can we revise structures upon which the nurturing of identities depends? And if judges have lived engaged lives in the community where they have experienced the joys, frustrations, aspirations, and disappointments of life, then so too have law professors. And those are all crucial to the contributions and human dimensions we bring to the task, and to the ways in which together we focus on the vocation of legal education and legal educators in designing the doors for fairness and justice and in making sure they're opened wide. On Thursday, I took myself to a cafe for the morning to treat myself to some thinking time devoted to my ongoing biographical project focused on the ways in which judging can be importantly linked to teaching and university leadership, to public policy engagement and institutional reform, to content and method of lawmaking. Biography often suggests the narrating of life story and the listing of achievements and accolades. But the biography of a jurist, as Rod MacDonald might insist, as a corollary to his essay, "What You See Depends on Where You Stand," has to be about all of the stuff in between the events and the awards and the marked moments. This is a project hard to write, not because of its subject, but because it is so much about its author, about my own dependence on colleagues and friends and students and life partner, about relationships as what Rod MacDonald labels the bedrock of law, about my own ongoing engagement with law, whether found in judgments or charters, constitutions or local bylaws, committee guidelines or children's stories. And that reminds me of the everyday, the children. Each and every day in my week includes parenting and the reasons and rules and resistance and renewal that are all part of the unrecorded reality of family life. In "But Everyone Else Is Allowed," Rod MacDonald distinguishes arbitrary from responsible parents by focusing on the need to listen to children's arguments about the very meaning, scope, and malleability of the rules. As he says, wise parents know that their rules alone do not provide specific solutions to specific problems. That kind of wisdom is hard to develop and maintain. This is teaching and learning around the clock about fairness, limits, transparency, explicit expectations, implicit norms, natural consequences, empowerment. My own children have concrete gifts from Rod MacDonald, a Swiss Army knife, and a subscription to the New York Review of Books. But those gifts are thinly disguised lessons for their parents, to encourage the children to find their own tools and words, create their own projects, and ask their own questions. None of this makes dinner table conversations any easier, but those conversations are the shapers of every day, Rod MacDonald's primary sources for reflecting on law's structures and potential. And so I arrive at Friday, today. With my agenda in hand, I am already looking ahead to tomorrow and the next day. I may not have had enough time, but throughout the week I was immersed in doing law in many of the ways Rod MacDonald envisages, describes, and prescribes, even if I didn't name them. Sometimes our sources are so integrated into our work that the footnotes fade. As Rod might say, sometimes the most important things have to remain unstated, just like he insists that sometimes we don't need specific rules, but rather general expressions of shared commitment. The diary of a law professor can feel full of nothing but blocks of under-inspired teaching, partial learning, best-in-the-circumstances decision-making, adequate reason providing, less than perfect attempts to show respect for the dignity of others, messy combinations of self-doubt and stepping up. But perhaps all of that is content and method of a life teaching and writing, creating and connecting, listening and reaching out. 20 years ago this month, Rod MacDonald invited me to go for our first McGill walk and talk in a snowstorm while we both ate Laura Secord ice cream cones. I don't remember the exact words. It was a life moment. It was a Rod moment. Of course it was a law moment. But it was also an ice cream moment in a blizzard, a moment to focus on what was important, to realize that a few snowflakes couldn't get in the way of a moment of sharing, an unstated moment that marked the beginning of so much time and so many life projects.
So I think many of us would agree that we could have had a whole panel on producing fairness regarding teaching, or producing fairness as a colleague working together. But we've been assigned the idea of producing fairness in the context of specific texts Rod has produced, and so I'm going to stick with that. And in my time this morning, I'm going to focus on two of the texts, Perspectives on Personal Relationships, which is essentially a sort of stand-in for the longer Beyond Conjugality report from the Law Commission of Canada, and Parameters of Politics in Judicial Appointments, the expert study prepared for the Bastarache Commission of Inquiry on the appointment of judges. And I'm going to tackle Richard's first question of impact on my work by separating out two matters, methodology and political sensibility or posture. And for the second question, implications for future research, I'm going to focus only on perspectives on personal relationships or beyond conjugality. So first, methodology. And I had a moment of panic when Harry Arthurs referred to methodology, but we're actually going to say different things. And Natalie's given us the gist of Perspectives on Personal Relationships and Parameters of Politics and Judicial Appointments. It's a lot of P's in the titles of these papers. And each sets out questions for how to approach thinking around appropriate possible legal approaches to a complex issue, recognizing and regulating adult interdependent relationships, selecting judges. And the methodological point I want to draw out is the way in which Rod borrows, registers, or lines of inquiry from one area of legal work and uses them in another. There's a kind of mixed methodology. So on close personal relationships, the work he's produced does, I admit, have a great sensitivity to affective dynamics. He is attentive to power and vulnerability. But there's also a very clear-eyed, very dispassionate willingness to broach the matter as if it were any other regulatory challenge. In a sense, it's emotionally very cool at times. What are our legislative objectives here? What are the instrument choices? What are the costs and benefits of each instrument choice? How much space is there for self-regulation, for example, for individuals to designate for themselves the relationships that matter most to them? Can we recognize relationships for some purposes and not others? And Rod's analysis around the use of the conjugal relationship as the vehicle for delivery of social programs pushes aside, quite ruthlessly, romantic assumptions about the couple that might otherwise cloud our appreciation of the regulatory stakes. And so he separates out the instrumental objectives from the symbolic ones. And so I think of it as being a kind of borrowing of the analytical rod that the secured transactions folks in the House on Kathy Walsh's panel perhaps are more familiar with. Transplantation into the field of family law and social policy in which there are a lot of sacred cows, a willingness to approach it like any other regulatory question. And that certainly affects my teaching of family law. And that sort of functionalism, I think, contrasts with Harry's reading that it's philosophy and poetry that we see as the methodological hallmarks of Rod's work. And people will recall that the upshot of this dispassionate analysis by the Law Commission led to recommendations that a number of statutes should simply stop centrally using the conjugal couple, and indeed led to the idea that the state might well get out of the marriage business entirely, although recognition that that might indeed be politically unfeasible. In the judicial appointments piece, we see a similar methodological move of transferring one mode of inquiry from one its usual home to another, but it's reversed. So the judicial appointment issue is one that many people speak about as if it can be done neutrally, and Natalie flagged this, as if it can be done apolitically, as if we can speak in objective terms about the best qualified judge, and imagine that an appointments process would arrive at only him or her. And Rod's paper for the Bastarache Commission takes the human elements as the point of departure, the necessity of a human judiciary for the rule of law, the idea that subjective human judgment necessarily inheres in the application of legal rules, the ineluctability of human judgment and human considerations in a selection process, and the idea, as Natalie said, that subjective judgment about judicial appointments might be disciplined, but never evacuated. So the methodological idea, as I see it, is that Rod's texts show a bringing together of different modes of inquiry, different kinds of concerns, in unexpected but often analytically rich and productive ways. We have a sense of integration, of methodological and intellectual pluralism that has deeply affected my scholarly work. Now I turn to the political posture, and I'll be a little briefer on this one. Each of these two texts, not to mention others during Rod's career, was potentially politically controversial. And Natalie has also signaled this, that the personal relationships piece really inspired some anger on the part of people fighting for gay and lesbian equality rights within the existing framework. And for its part, the judicial appointment paper dared to try to distinguish illegitimate from legitimate political considerations, something risky and controversial in a climate in which the very idea of political decisions was, I think, and remains discredited. And any involvement in the political process by someone eventually named a judge is seen as suspect. And there was a real witch hunt climate around the commission. The idea that someone named a judge who had once donated $100 to the political party that named her, that was somehow a sign of corruption and inappropriate influence. And I think Rod is fearless, or at least he appears fearless. And Natalie called him a liberation terrorist. He appears fearless in voicing hypotheses, critiques, and conclusions that may irritate or anger people, and even people who would expect Rod to be his ally on certain issues. And so, as someone who tries to merge academically rigorous critique with activism around sexual justice issues, I bear Rod's example in mind. And I remind myself that the scholar's job isn't always to be making friends, or perhaps not as the primary objective of the work. And so there's a difference between voicing the conclusions to which one's principles and inquiries lead one, and always advancing a group's short-term interests. And as we turn now to the implications for future research. So what implications does the work on personal relationships have, including beyond conjugality, for future research? And it's a very important question, because as people in the room know very well, the Law Commission has been shut down. Its website has been shut down, which is a reminder that even in the internet era, it's not crazy to put paper copies in libraries. But Beyond Conjugality continues to be read, to be cited, to inspire scholars to debate and think hard. I've attended international conferences where Americans in the room are citing Beyond Conjugality. It continues to be cited in the research of a number of people. I'm editor of a forthcoming collection called After Legal Equality, Family, Sex, Kinship, and a number of the authors referred to the Law Commission's work on these matters. For example, in connection with the taxation regime's abiding focus on the conjugal couple. And it seems to me that aggressively fairness-based and objective-focused analysis around relationships is particularly crucial. It remains important at a moment after same-sex marriage, after legislative or judicial efforts to recognize cohabiting conjugal couples. Many people assume at the present time that all relevant relationships have been appropriately dealt with and that the personal relationships agenda is over. And I think Rod's work continues to have the potential substantively methodologically to aid ongoing reflections and debates. So with deeply integrated methodologies, with a fearlessness around the political implications of work, and ongoing inspiration, we see themes that I imagine will recur repeatedly as today and tomorrow we pursue the conversation in honor of our dear friend, colleague, and teacher Rod MacDonald.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here to celebrate Rod and to talk about how great his work is. Rod was my PhD advisor, and so the influence of his scholarship on my thinking and writing is, to borrow from him, explicit and authorized, but also implicit and inferential in whatever instantiation that may take. I'm wearing a modified bow tie for Rod, but it makes me kind of feel like an old-timey flight attendant, so I apologize. Anyway, I'm going to address how Rod's writing in multiple venues, in different forms, and to diverse audiences has influenced my teaching, or I'd like to believe that it's influenced my teaching, and how his work as an educator remains important to anyone thinking seriously about legal education. I draw on these five texts to probe Rod's pedagogical imagination. He would prefer, rather than pedagogy, that we say andragogy, but I just have a hard time saying that word, so I'm going to go with pedagogy. I start with his piece on procedural fairness to discuss how his pedagogical imagination translates more concretely in the classroom, and especially regarding student assessments. I then examine Rod's broader vision of teaching to highlight some of his concerns about the instrumentalization of legal education while foregrounding his belief in and profound optimism about students' desire and potential to achieve a more just world. In A Theory of Procedural Fairness, Rod states that fairness in decision-making occurs first when there is meaningful participation afforded to those affected, and second, when the reasons for that decision are properly conveyed. In reading, I was struck by how his description of fairness in that context spoke to some of my own concerns about how to provide meaningful and fair student assessments. The guidelines he sets out in that article regarding the rights of participants in non-adjudicative decision-making can be applied, I argue, to the rights of law students to participate in their own education. I believe that the principles of procedural fairness articulated by Rod in that context in 1981 form the basis of his pedagogical injunctions, of which I have found eight. One, participants have the right to know in advance the subject matter being decided. Likewise, we must clearly explain to students in advance of their assessments the criteria against which their work will be measured, rather than leaving it to them to guess what we're looking for. Two, participants have the right to an adjournment and to prepare submissions fully. Students, too, should be afforded an appropriate amount of time to prepare, complete, and importantly, reflect upon their work. Three, participants can engage counsel to assist in the presentation of facts and opinion. Similarly, students have complex lives and perspectives. These are resources in their learning, in their peers' learning, in their professors' learning, too. We should deploy collaborative assignments that invite interaction and feedback between first and upper year students, between students of different disciplines, and among members of the same cohort. Four, participants have the right to file supplementary comments. We know that some students, some of our brightest students even, do not excel in high-pressure, think-on-your-feet environments. We need different methods of assessments, including self-assessments that invite reflection after the fact, that allow different learning styles to shine, and encourage students' progress and improvement over time. Five, participants have the right to know exactly the identity of the decision maker. And this is a theme that's been brought up by some of my colleagues. Assessments require transparency, for sure, but assessing students also requires a self-awareness of the beliefs and the experiences that shape the way we teach, the modes of evaluations we value, and the learning outcomes we desire to achieve. Six, decision makers must honestly and genuinely attend to the facts and opinions advanced. Professors should respond to students as individuals and as members of diverse communities using subjective, yes, subjective, yet fair criteria for formative evaluations, balancing an ethics of care and an ethics of justice. Seven, participants have the right to re-argument and reconsideration. Students should be encouraged to make mistakes and to explore new iterations of thoughts and skills by reflecting on those mistakes. And finally, eight, there is an explicit right to appeal a decision on the merits. I read this in two ways. First of all, there should be appropriate channels for formative assessments of professors that invite us to learn and to improve. And second, professors are human beings who, however diligent, will make mistakes. And while all mistakes are teaching moments, some errors actually require the intervention of a third party. These injunctions demonstrate how Rod, in whatever context he's writing about law, is also talking about how to invigorate legal education, how to provide rewarding experiences both for students and professors. That said, and this has been said a few times already, well beyond the universe of the law school, Rod has championed the view that the lessons we learn about law are those we discover through interactions. I was actually introduced to Rod at a conference in one of these everyday teaching and learning moments, and he asked me two things. The first thing he asked me was to spell the word advisor. I was so nervous. I can't tell you the outcome of that question. The second thing he asked me was, And what will I learn from you? And I know, I know he is not meaning to intimidate me, but my goodness, Rod, come on. His belief, his profound belief, and one that I've learned to believe in my own interactions with students, is that learning is polyvalent, unfinished, and a multidirectional process. And that brings me to my final point. Beyond the parameters and sites of legal learning, Rod has provided us with an ethics of education. Teaching law is not just about having skills or providing resources or deploying particular methods or techniques, nor is it about helping students acquire tools, habits, and knowledge. I mean, it is about that, but it's not just about helping students become good jurists. In his text on judicial appointments, he explains that education must aim to embolden us to resist the siren songs of conventional adulthood, most notably reputation and popular acclaim. And this is the beginning of the quote that Shauna has already used, but I think it bears repeating. Instead, we are to retain the precious idealism of youth, those moments of wide-eyed wonderment that impel the constant discovery and rediscovery of self. In terms of the future-oriented hypothesis, Rod's is that legal education is aspiration, and he enjoins us to make education part of a worthy life project of inquiries, interactions, and discoveries that nurture the kind of virtues in ourselves that will help produce a more just society.
Good morning, everyone. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. To the extent that our first task on this panel was to comment on how the texts that have been assigned to us have influenced our own work, for me, it's really less about the influence of these texts specifically or even the themes contained in them than with the cast of mind that animates all of them. And there really are not words to capture how much I have been influenced by that particular cast of mind, and profound will have to do for now. And I suspect Rod would probably try and say that it's been less a case of influence than it has a kind of meeting of like kinds. And maybe that's the case, but I'm nonetheless convinced that my own cast of mind, whatever it might be, would not have found its way to expression had I not spent so many precious hours as a master student of Rod's developing my mind in conversation with him. And at risk of destroying the standards of politeness in the room, I would recount that I would appear at Rod's doorway from time to time, often unannounced, and politely ask if I could interrupt because there was something I wanted to talk about. And he'd say to me, "Well, Chief, if you want to talk about ideas, you're welcome any time. But if you want to talk about bullshit, you can go." And so, try as I did and continue to do with some inevitable lapses on that ideas to bullshit continuum, I try and stick on the ideas side. But all I can say succinctly is I owe Rob McDonald much, and I blame him for perhaps still more. So through those conversations with Rod, I came to learn some crucial things about perspective. And by perspective, I mean primarily to indicate two things. First, how Rod always keeps the abstract and the real, the high theoretical, the nuts and bolts, the normative and the practice, not just in view, but in contact with each other. In the Rod cast of mind, we have none of the siloed silliness of insulated concepts that are untouched and untainted by the vagaries of the real world, nor do we have a real world that somehow gets on without noting the significance of the animating ideas running through it. They are always in contact. It's an enormous intellectual challenge to work with that. It's an enormous methodological challenge to work with that. But to be mentored at some point by Rod is to have that instilled by you, and it never goes away. But I also mean to signal the importance of perspective in Rod's work in a more specific sense, by which how following his cast of mind we're led to consider the perspective of the person on the bottom, the person on the top, the guy in the middle, the person at the side, those who've come before, those who are yet to come, and not to mention the rest. And it's this sense of perspective that I want to comment on as a foundation of my remarks on two of the texts assigned, which is his 1981 piece on procedural fairness and the Law Commission of Canada reference on restoring dignity in the context of child institutionalisation. Suzanne very helpfully just outlined for us some of the gist of that procedural fairness piece about its quality of participation emphasis, appropriate reasons and so forth, and of course the ultimate ROD commitment to refuse to tie an idea to any particular kind of institutional configuration, especially one from the adjudicative context. But I want to go a little deeper into what's going on in that procedural fairness piece, to explore it in relation to the triangle that I always see at play in the Rod McDonald cast of mind, and that's a triangle that joins ideas, institutions and persons, specifically our lived experience as persons. And in both of those texts, the focus is especially on the perspective of the person on the bottom. And here we might use various terms to capture this condition of personhood with which Rod is so enduringly concerned. We might speak of dignity, or we might speak of agency, or as he does in the 1981 piece, we might speak of enfranchisement. But either way, what we're going to be assured will take from a Rod McDonald cast of mind is an awareness that these statuses and capacities do not come with the territory of being simply human. They are constituted in the relations we have with others, and as a macro version of that, with and within institutions. Now, this idea is, of course, present in Fuller, whose writings Rod has been deeply influenced by. But as someone who knows Fuller's canon rather well, I'd say that Fuller still needs a bit of help now and then to pull those ideas out, whereas in a McDonald cast of mind, they are always front and centre. He is always, in his legal imagination, asking what a given institutional design, a given process will mean for those interacting with it. And this is a commitment that runs all the way down. He pays intricate attention, and we see that especially in the Law Commission of Canada Restoring Dignity reference, to what each kind of possible process will mean for those who participate and are affected by it. So we end up with an idea of procedural fairness that is about personhood. And it is a demand of personhood that says that if we are to constitute and sustain it in these processes, we have to begin at the beginning by allowing those affected by a decision or by any kind of process to play a role in choosing the process itself. And what's at stake in this choice is not so much a matter of efficacy, although it is in various ways also that, but rather goes to the much deeper and more fundamental issue of intelligibility. And I really think, pondering this in the last few days, that this is the nub of Rod McDonald on procedural fairness, intelligibility as a state of personhood that we experience in relation to the structures around us. So to speak of procedural fairness is to ponder how the possibility of the equality of persons can be generated by and through an appropriate institutional design in a way that makes sense to them, their expectations, and perhaps most crucially, the aggrieved experience that brought them there. Because if we don't take this thought about personhood, how it's generated and how it's also negated by design, then the personhood game might well be over before it even begins. So from Rod's world, there's no theorisation and no practice of the normative demands of procedural fairness. It does not start and end in this figure of the person, what they need and what makes sense to them. I want to briefly move from that intricate attention we get in the Law Commission of Canada reference to why I think that idea, those ideas, is so crucially important to the here and now of institutional life, and this is one way of signalling future directions for research. I want to suggest that Rod's thinking on procedural fairness has a crucial contribution to make to how we understand and how we are to evaluate and how we are to respond to the institutional architecture of neoliberalism. And I think there's an affinity here that is beautifully disruptive, and it's one that I think I personally want to carry through. In the institutional landscape of neoliberalism, we need Rod McDonald's thinking on personhood and institutional design for a range of reasons. It is a landscape which, in its move to private modes of ordering, which are not per se a problem, especially in the Rod McDonald legal imagination, sees a range of relational dynamics that sustain institutions and, by extension, that sustain conditions of personhood within institutions, potentially and very frequently severed. Means become exclusively instrumental, ideas of responsibility are reconfigured, and lines of vision are blurred by design. So why do we need a McDonald cast of mind to see this diagnostically and also to respond to it normatively? First, because we're in the realm of the administrative, which is the realm of Rod McDonald par excellence. The administrative realm, as Rod always has pointed out to us, is one characterised by un or under-specification, and so this is what generates not only the need for choices to be made, but responsibility for making those choices. But the administrative space is also, of course, the space where people directly experience their place within a political order or any kind of order vis-a-vis their relations with others. This is where the rubber hits the road. It's where we find out what's what. And that is why this idea of intelligibility that we take from Rod on procedural fairness is so crucial. We might ask how we are to understand that idea of intelligibility, especially in human services contexts, and still more especially in contexts which implicate a high degree of vulnerability on the part of persons affected. What does intelligibility mean, for instance, when those services are outsourced? If one is, for instance, a beneficiary of an outsourced prison or immigration removal service or elder care or children's home, where one is rarely, if ever, party to the contracts that institutes the arrangements affecting them, nor able to access the content of those arrangements because of all sorts of restrictions on information, commercial confidentiality, and so forth. We have a transformation where people who used to be subject to state action of some kind, but nonetheless in some kind of direct relation to the state, are now, as a matter of design, cut loose from that relationship, not permitted to participate in, witness, or in many cases even understand the surrounding institutional frame with which they are being treated and with which they are living. Normally, I think it would be right to say that to speak of procedural fairness in this context is to speak of a language from another age, something tied to a different way of doing administration, a different way of understanding the relationship between decisions and persons. We could say that in this kind of neoliberal institutional design world, those ideas are outdated, but not if we take Rod MacDonald's understanding of what procedural fairness boils down to. And so it's that idea that I think we need to excavate and reassert, these foundations of enfranchised personhood that go to the nub of Rod's conception of procedural fairness, is what I think have much work to do diagnostically and normatively in response to the here and now of institutional life in so many of the countries in which we live. And indeed, at the end of that procedural fairness article, Rod speaks in his high-low way of how this idea of procedural fairness is like a portal to big questions of legal and political philosophy. And I think that continues to ring true if we to illuminate the relational foundations and expectations of that idea of procedural fairness in the context of some of these newer configurations of institutional design. Then we are led to crucial questions of legal and political philosophy concerning the nature of authority, the meaning of the rule of law, just to name two. So to return very briefly in conclusion to the influence of Rod MacDonald on my own work, I wrote a book on Fuller and I emphasised the interactions in his thought of form and agency. I continue to seek to explore the big questions of legal philosophy from the perspective of the person on the bottom, the legal subject. And when theory drives me nuts, which it frequently does, I remind myself of why it matters by turning to questions like this. If Rod MacDonald's paw prints are not all over that life project, I don't know whose are. Thank you.
So I think there are a number of people that are listed to speak on the issue, Richard. Or do you want? Okay.
Good morning. My name is Kathleen Mahoney, and I'm a law professor from the University of Calgary. And we have 2 minutes, so much less than the people on the panel, to talk about the influence of Rod's work on ourselves and our research plans. My story is going to be focused on the Restoring Dignity report, because I was the chief negotiator for the Assembly of First Nations settling the Indian Residential School matter. And I was tasked with coming up with something which would improve the debacle which had been formulated by Canada when it ignored Rod's work and did the ADR process, which ended up re-victimizing survivors and creating a lot of turmoil in the country about that. And those people that were well aware of what was going on will remember that turmoil. But in any event, the report that was produced by the Law Commission was an absolutely invaluable framework for us to work with. It's a direction to consult with survivors and bring them on the team. Its emphasis on collective sensibilities and remedies for the group as well as the individuals. And as a consequence of that, we resulted in achieving the largest and most comprehensive holistic settlement in Canadian history, composed not only of fair compensation that went well beyond tort law, but also recognition of loss of language and culture, which every single survivor was compensated for, a truth commission, healing funds, commemoration funds, and many other aspects, including an apology from the Prime Minister in the House of Commons with the galleries full of survivors and their families. I take my hat off to the Commission and especially Rod MacDonald because, frankly, the inspiration came from there. In terms of my future research, it is also very connected to exactly that. Forms of redress, inclusion as opposed to exclusion, and examining why the law does not allow us to go there and how we have to focus on expanding those borders, penetrating those rules, and educating our future lawyers to be inclusive, not exclusive, to look beyond their own cultures and ethnicities, and to include really everyone in the law as opposed to just a few. Thank you, Rod. You did it for us.
Hello. My name is Finn Mackle. I'm a professor at the Université de Sherbrooke Faculty of Law. So when I first met Rod, I was often identified by others and pretty well self-identified as a Marxist. And I was 25, so I was at a moment that was pretty difficult because people kept telling me that if you're not a Marxist by the time you're 20, you've got no heart. And if you're not establishment by the time you're 30, then you've got no brain. When I first met Rod, he said, yes, but there's a corollary. And that's if you're not a Marxist again by the time you're 50, then you've got neither. which led me immediately to wonder why he wasn't one. So Rod does very occasionally, address class in his written work. He's addressed it much more often in conversation with me. And we've had a lot of arguments about it, among other things, the question of what is the role of power that was brought up by Harry Arthurs has been an ongoing discussion between he and I. We both agreed, and his vision was, I guess, congenial to me in the sense that there's a shared suspicion on our part of the capacity of the official laws of the political state to redress injustice. But how we cash that out comes quite differently. He tends to use, rather than this notion of class, oppression, he uses the notion of enfranchisement, which shows up in the procedural fairness piece. And I think one of the fundamental insights that I've drawn from his work is that enfranchisement is not a question of law or not law, but rather we need to look at our category, our understanding of law itself, to include implicit norms, non-state law, and so forth, in order to think about who gets left out of our conception of law. And so in his work, I saw this, for instance, in his work, the piece on small claims court can't, and the exclusion that isn't an explicit exclusion, but rather an implicit one. And of course, it's lessons of everyday law is shot through with that perspective. So in that sense, I think Rod's legal pluralism is necessarily linked to his questions of enfranchisement and justice. I want to say a couple just really briefly about method, which has been touched on a couple of times here. One of the things that that I've seen in Rod's work and that informs my work is that it's just not enough to simply assert the inadequacy of standard conceptions of law. You need to do the demonstration. And one of the rhetorical strategies and intellectual strategies that Rod deploys, and which I'm also a fan of, is the creation of detailed taxonomies. So you see this, for instance, in the procedural fairness work, but there's also a great article of Rod's from around the same time, 1983, called Absence of Jurisdiction, a Perspective. And there's a wonderful footnote in there where Rod says that there's, in fact, 26 different ways in which a tribunal cannot have jurisdiction. And the interesting thing about this intellectual method or rhetorical strategy, because it's both, is that Rod shows that he's capable and understands, and he invites others to unpack in a serious and attentive way the positive law. And then once you get the taxonomy on the ground is the moment where you get to say, see, there's gaps everywhere. And so in terms of my own work, that's a methodological insight that I've taken, and there's a certain stance that comes with that, which means that if you're going to deal with these questions, whether you do it in terms of enfranchisement or in terms of class, the way to do it is by engagement and not by abandonment. Thank you, Rob.
My name is Annalise Acorn. I'm a professor of law at the University of Alberta. One of the questions that I ask myself and my students when reading a book or an article is, does this piece of scholarship contribute to a scholarly culture that you want to be a part of? Does it enliven your intellect? Does it nurture your imagination? Does it invite you to think adventurously about justice? Do you find in there any vivid insights about law and the human condition? If there's one scholar who inspires in me a resounding yes to all of those questions, it's Rod MacDonald. We've been asked to focus on the text, so I want to say a few things in a little more detail about one of my favorites, maybe my favorite, Lessons of Everyday Law. This book explicitly sets out to bridge the cavernous divide between the real world and the academy, and it succeeds by combining personal, original, vivid stories with immediately recognizable images with rigorous legal analysis. Kids dividing a chocolate bunny informs an amazingly interesting discussion of procedurals for distributive justice. A ski hill disagreement between Rod and his son about Celsius and Fahrenheit on a darn cold day informs a wonderful discussion of the illusion of perfect rationality in legal categories. The sea stroke versus windy day sea stroke and Huck Finn renaming a shovel a jackknife informs an amazing discussion of legal fictions. Rod is an exemplar of Einstein's maxim, make everything as simple as possible and no simpler. Every gem of a chapter in this book demonstrates Rod's sensitivity and acuity of perception, his inventiveness in creating conceptual structures to illuminate those perceptions, and the guts that he has to deliver concept and perception without a jot of intellectual pretension. Rod sees law in so many of its social hiding places, in the lineup for the bus, in the arguments that kids make about why they should be able to stay up later on Halloween, in the naming of professional sports teams, and his clear-sightedness in those contexts is key to his gifts for illuminating law in all the old familiar places, the courtroom, the legislature, and the administrative tribunal. He's also an exemplar of George Orwell's rules of good writing, and in particular, never use a stale image, and the implication of that, use images. It's been mentioned already, but the richness of his metaphor of fixing the dock after every winter's ice damage is dazzling. Somebody, I think it was Wittgenstein, but it could have been anybody, said that the Academy is an oxygen-deprived environment. I can say that had it not been for the intellectual oxygen that Rod gave me at crucial moments of my life and my career, I would not have survived. Thank you, Rod.
I am Louis Maheu from the Université de Montréal, and I must confess up front that I'm not from the quote-unquote legal world, even writ very large. I'm a sociologist of new social movements, and our roads, Rod and mine, crisscross in many different ways in the last years. One important one being the Royal Society of Canada. And every time that I had a chance to read Rod's stuff, and I've done it again yesterday and the day before, I'm amazed by Rod's touch. Now, mind you, we're speaking of a Charbonneau Commission commissioner, the touch here is not a famous boat. It is totally different. It is a style, a very transparent and clear and familiar style that really simplifies complex issues. And there are two dichotomies to which I would like to pinpoint because they are very important. They have been addressed by at least Natalie and Shona a few minutes ago. The one is in between the content of law as being rules on the one side, and the other side being something else that we find in text as being defined as aspirations. I think that is absolutely crucial for a sociologist of my kind. And the other, and aspirations are very important because they provide the values, the justification, the groundings of what should be good rules, actually. And the other dichotomy, which is very important, is everyday life on the one side and legal official law on the other side, everyday law and official law. When we look at the official law through the dichotomy of rules and aspirations, for example, it's very important because we would find within the aspiration, the values, justification, groundings of what should be the rules. And that should be, for example, a concept of democracy, being not only rules, but a social project of justice, a rational, legitimate authority as funding power, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if we come to the everyday law, and we look at the aspiration side of the everyday law, then I'm puzzled by the fact that it should, I think, be seen as something like the human right of an individual to be an actor, the human right of an individual to control and define its own life. The recognition by this human being that the other is also a self, and perhaps a modern self, if we allude to Taylor's way of defining what is the self. And so I would be very interested to go more in that direction. What would be the full aspiration dimension of everyday life? And can we escape to define it? Something like the human rights universe. That, I think, is a question I would like perhaps Natalie and Shona to comment on.
My turn? Okay, my name's Campbell Stewart. I practice law in Montreal and have done for, I guess now, many years. And my comment now is not, and I do apologize, but not really, I'm not going to make any reference to any of Rod's written works or anything like that. In fact, in looking through this list of particular subjects, I couldn't find a single one that is appropriate for my comment. So I thought, well, isn't that perfect? I'm just going to tell you one story. I was in this room, as near as I can figure, either in this chair or in the chair in this lucky gentleman in front of me. And it would have been, I guess, in 1982. And this young fellow at the front, at least he was only a year older than I was, I think, still is, was teaching a class in jurisprudence. And it was my fourth year. And things were getting a little dreary, I have to admit, by that time. This gentleman in the front started to talk about the nature of knowledge, epistemology, that sort of thing, Wittgenstein. I was beginning to understand a little bit, and then he asked a question. He says, how many ways can you figure that the sign, keep off the grass, is wrong or is inapplicable? It was as though it was a bolt of lightning to me. The lights came on. The interest came back. It was Rod MacDonald doing what Rod MacDonald does best, I think. And that is not just write about it, and I apologize for not having read a lot of it, Rod, but by influencing the students that pass through his class in a real and a fundamental way. I'm eternally grateful for that, because in my practice, I enjoy my practice mainly because I've learned how to negotiate, because I've learned how to settle, because I've learned how to talk to people. And a big piece of that was by deconstructing, I guess, if that's the right term, a little bit of the silos we put everything in. And I'll just finish with one comment. I have spent innumerable hours arguing with bureaucrats, fonctionnaires, people in the various commissions we all have to deal with in our practice, and it has occurred to me more than once to suggest, wait a minute, what are you saying? I have someone you ought to talk to. This is not, you're not making any sense at all. I don't care what you think you're saying. You're not actually serving the purposes for which you are being employed. They don't like to hear that, so we never had that lunch. But I'm not going to go on too long, but I would like to say thank you. As a former student, I learned a hell of a lot, and thank you, thank you, thank you.
Okay, well, I think this is the right crowd to say that I was one of those academic weirdos in law school. I fit in there like a square peg into the round hole and was hanging in there. And here comes Professor MacDonald to be our law review lecturer when I was in third year. And his talk, it just convinced me, wow, you can be a law professor and you can say those kind of things and get paid, you know? I was like, okay, I can do this. So I went off to do a couple of tours of duty in practice to pay off some debt, and the whole time in the back of my head thinking, I'm going to get to McGill. I'm going to do an LLM, and I'm going to do it with Professor MacDonald. So when I showed up, okay, I was happy, very happy. I show up at his office, kind of unannounced, and said, okay, I'm here. I'm ready to go. I'm so happy to be back in law school. And he says, yeah, but Nicole, this is a law faculty. It's not a law school. And then I walked down the hill back to my apartment thinking, I have really no idea what that means, because it's a law school, right? So I've spent the last 12 years at various times thinking, I'm starting to grasp the difference between law school and law faculty. And let me tell you about three of the ways that differentiation has mattered to me just in the last month. Many of you may have known that the faculty at the University of New Brunswick, where I work, there was a strike and then we got locked out. So we spent 3 weeks on the picket line in January, 25 below. Good thing I'm from Saskatchewan, I could handle it. but I found myself talking about colonization and university collegial governance models and how we need to shift this and how we actually need a faculty club. right? All the times we drank beer at the faculty club, we really need one at UMB. Anyway, all these things, they were coming through me, but the voice of Rod McDonald was coming forth on the picket line. And then the other day, we get back to class on Monday, and I'm teaching my Aboriginal Law seminar, and I find myself saying the following, okay? I find myself saying, the assertion of Canadian sovereignty is actually a legal fiction, and so we can actually change that, so we can find a way to decolonize the country so that Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people can work together, and we can build new constitutional norms, right? Like, I'm saying this, I'm like, oh my God, this is Rod McDonald again, right? Okay, so then the third thing, I'm in class on Wednesday, my criminal law class, first year. I let them do group presentations, and I basically say the wilder the better, don't bore me. That's kind of the only instruction I really give. And what the students had done, there's five people in this group, they had colluded with my husband to get a film clips of my little dog, and then they had my dog debating a cat on the merits of the latest dog sniffer case coming out of the Supreme Court of Canada in the fall, on the point that the jurisprudence from the Supreme Court of Canada is always changing and shifting in time. And they had this big debate, and they did a whole Ludlow Hall news reel and video and everything. And I'm going to send you the video, Rod, because I'll tell you, these students made me so proud. And what I'd learned from you is the wilder the better in the classroom, because they're actually learning and taking over their own education. And I'm enjoying it thoroughly. And thank you for convincing me that a weirdo like me in law school can actually go be a law professor. So thank you.
So I'm Susan Zimmerman, and I've known Rod in two ways, and I have to follow up on Campbell Stuart, because I'm going to speak for that voiceless mass of people known as bureaucrats. Because, having started out here, I ended up in Ottawa, and I've had the experience of living through Rod in Ottawa in two ways. First, as his director of research at the Law Commission of Canada. And I used to attend meetings with him and bureaucrats. And if you think he's unbounded by constraints in a law school setting, you can imagine what an impact bureaucratic restraints have on him. None. He doesn't even recognize them. Usually he's not aware he's broken them. So we'd go to these meetings while he would be expounding on what he hoped to do with the Law Commission, and I could see the eyes around the room. They had no idea what he was talking about. But the fabulous thing about Rod, I used to think for a while that I could be his interpreter. You know, people would say, what do you do at the Law Commission? I said, I'm an interpreter. But the wonderful thing about Rod, one of the many wonderful things about Rod, is that, as Wittgenstein, or whoever, said, there is no question, whatever he has said that you think is incomprehensible or complex or beyond your reach, when asked to explain, he is always able to explain it clearly, concisely, and that concept remains with you. And that is a tremendous gift that even had an impact on bureaucrats in Ottawa, so who eventually realized that he was best left to his own devices to do good things, which he did until they yanked all the money. But never mind. So the second way in which I'm experiencing Rod McDonald in Ottawa is in my current life and as a bureaucrat. And there are two things people don't generally think of when they're young and aspiring to be something something when they're older. They don't think they'll be a bureaucrat, and they don't think they'll wield power. And it takes a long time to realize that that's actually what you're doing. And that realization has come to me in my current job. And this discussion this morning has reminded me of why the job I have now is both so difficult and challenging and so important, and why the grounding I had from Rod is so absolutely critical to my functioning. Because I realize that I and my office do wield power over people's lives, their careers, in an administrative law setting where, as I think Kristen said, it's marked by underspecification. Boy, that's no exaggeration. Yeah, in many cases, you're making it up as you go along because the rules and the guideposts are not really there in any concrete way. And all you have to rely on, and this is both the daily challenge and the profound responsibility, is first principles. What is the impact of what you're doing, having, on the people to whom you're doing it, and what is their role in having a say in what happens to them? And if you take that seriously, as many bureaucrats, I'd like to say, do, it is an awesome responsibility and an extremely exciting opportunity to make all the thinking and all the reflection that goes on in law faculties become real. Because unless you're doing it every day, and sometimes it's things as simple as picking up a phone and talking to someone instead of sending them a letter. Sometimes it's thinking out that you don't send the form letter, you do something different. And I think that my inspiration to do that, including with people who send 10-page letters with lots of capitals and underlinings, and you all, I think, know what I'm talking about, is to remember that behind that there is someone who has been impacted by some action, perhaps of the state, and who deserves some form of redress. Maybe not the form you have the ability to provide, but something. And to be constantly creative and thoughtful and never lose sight of the person to whom you are responsible, and those are members of the public. So, Rod, apart from the direct influence you had in providing me with daily challenges when we worked together, daily challenges and daily pleasures when we worked together, I just want you to know that your sensibility and your humanity, I hope, informed to some extent what I do every day.
Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres interventions? Are there people that want to speak on... Yes, Carrie.
Maybe I'm Carrie Riddick from the University of Toronto. Maybe just a really brief footnote to the many wonderful things people have already said. I thought I'd just make a fragmentary connection, if I could, between the topic of the panel, producing fairness, and Rod's evident and magnificent interest in questions of genre and form in legal scholarship. And forgive me if I illustrate this by way of a personal anecdote. The first extended conversation that I ever had with Rod was at Harvard Law School almost 10 years ago, when he gave a predictably brilliant and persuasive speech about McGill's relatively recent move to trans-systemic legal education. This was a moment in time in which Harvard was thinking it needed to become more transnational, and there was Rod to describe one way to do it. What I remember first about our encounter was his intense interest in where I came from. And I told him that I was a musician. And the first thing he said was, "Have you written about it?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, why not?" In a slightly accusatory tone, as if it was an evident and obvious gap, no matter whatever else I had thought I had achieved. And this has stuck in my mind for a very long time. It was an exhilarating reminder that there was a limitless horizon of fields and projects that all of us could do, the wonderful moment of opening up rather than closing down. So what's the possible connection with the questions of producing fairness? One of the puzzles that I'm continually confronting in my own scholarship is the limits of rational exposition, both as a mode of capturing and moving debate about the legal issues in which I'm engaged. particularly in the realm of economic justice, in the world of work, I think almost every labor law scholar will have some version of this experience. And that experience is that the conventional mode of doing legal scholarship increasingly fails to persuade, but more than that, it fails to convey what's at stake. And so one intuition about the connection between producing fairness and genre and form is that changing the ground on which determinations about justice and fairness are made, the very frozen and congealed ground, increasingly seems to depend on successfully evoking another world, changing what we hear and what we see and how we experience that world. And I am pushed more and more towards the belief that my own future, but maybe the future of all of us, is going to have to engage more explicitly in perhaps radical interventions at the level of genre and form. I think Daniel Jutras tacitly suggested something along these lines when he opened the event this morning with a song and his guitar. But in any event, what I first experienced as simply a tantalizing and inviting possibility has now moved to the realm of an ineluctable necessity.
We have the time for a couple more interventions, and then I'll invite people on the panel if they have additional response or comments. Sean.
Hi. My name's Sean Rehegg. I'm on faculty at Osgoode and was one of Rod's students here at McGill. I wanted to... Rod has had a whole number of impacts on my approaches as a scholar and very much as a teacher as well. But I just wanted to share one kind of anecdote of a moment related to procedural fairness and justice where I tried to channel Rod. So I do a lot of empirical quantitative work on what explains outcomes in immigration and refugee applications, and I can show that one of the key factors is who your judge is. So you have some board members who grant refugee protection in virtually every case they hear, and others who have never granted refugee protection despite hearing hundreds of cases. And so I do this work, and the Immigration and Refugee Board thought that it was interesting and so invited me to come give a presentation to Immigration and Refugee Board members. So there were 50 people who make these decisions sitting in the room. They weren't particularly pleased that their names were in the newspaper because of studies that I was doing, saying that, you know, they never granted refugee protection. So I gave my presentation, and one of the board members who had never granted refugee protection asks a question or makes a comment, and his comment is, you know, this is all very nice, interesting statistics, but at the end of the day, all I care about is whether the federal court upholds my decisions, and my decisions are not frequently overturned. So my first thought was, you went to the wrong law school. You should have gone to McGill, and you should have taken a course in administrative process with Rod. And then I did try to channel Rod and maybe a little bit of Lon Fuller as well, and suggested that that the position that he was taking was the equivalent of an architect who was saying, in response to a question about why a building that the architect had designed, why was it a good building? What made it a good building? And his answer, the architect's answer, is, well, it meets the building code. So I tried to channel Rod at that particular moment. I don't know that the bureaucrats in the room really got it, but it has led to me in my scholarship to think more carefully about how to explain to decision makers, some of whom don't have legal training, if the answer is it meets the building code is not the right answer, then what is the right answer? So thanks, Rod.
It was really a clubby, sort of clubby white male atmosphere, and of course the uniform was shirt and long tie to teach, because that's only respectable people teach like that. And the bow tie was in some sense his way of inhabiting the institution, but inhabiting it in his own way, which to me is maybe a simple but more subtle lesson that you can see in a lot of his writings, for example, in Office Politics, where, let's say, a lot of legal academics have formed in the 1970s and law students to have a bit, say, what some people have called truth psychosis. They would, like, tear off the mask and say, ah, you're a hypocrite, and such. Whereas, I think Professor MacDonald, as you can see in the loving way that he depicts these various law school characters and the way they pursue their interests and such, is to respect people's needs to have what you might see as masks, but in some sense their way of protecting themselves or their way of inhabiting their institutions. And a lesson that I learned from him as leading a bit from that is that you don't actually know what it's like, this is a bit of a life lesson, to be really someone and what it actually costs them to do certain things. So when you see that people are sort of barely polite to you or such, and you think it might be hypocrisy, you actually don't know what actual anger or difficulties or such they have inside themselves. In some sense, yes. So, to sum up, yes, that yes, people have masks, but in fact, the purposes of those masks serve, and that very human point that I think we can all really bring to everyday life as well to our scholarship. Thank you.
Hello.
Oh, yes.
My name is Adele Blackett.
Oh, yeah,
and bonjour.
Bonjour.
I had the privilege in 1993 to be one of Rod's research assistants and had the opportunity to see the empirical side of things in some level. We were working on the long-standing and path-breaking work that Rod has done on access to justice. And at that stage in that work, the summer involved going out into community, speaking with members of a variety of groups that comprise Montreal, racialized communities, communities of religious communities. Frankly, I was meeting with local hairdressers, teachers, musicians, priests, and asking them what it was about the way that they resolved relationships, whether those relationships entailed going to courts, which usually it didn't, or not. And during, Rod had already undertaken a very significant amount of the theorizing around his work on access to justice. And I was rather stunned at the end of the summer when Rod said, basically, we'd been asking the wrong questions all summer. And really moved toward, of course, a much more critical approach to thinking about legal pluralism. But the comment that struck me the most in that summer was Rod's anticipation of the deep concern I had as someone committed to social justice outcomes. And it could be seen quite clearly at that stage that the work was leading to a deep questioning of who really had access to justice? Was it really those for whom the institutions themselves were designed? And anticipating the question, Rod very matter-of-factly said, this research could, of course, if it were politically feasible, lead to courts really rethinking whether one should have small claims courts or not. And it was clearly posed on the table as a central part of the inquiry that the short-term implications of eventually sealing off the distributive dimensions of the work were to be acknowledged, but that the research itself, the integrity of the research and where it would lead was far more important. Rod's work and the way that it has continued in that direction, his work in particular in everyday law and its challenge to the informality, has been deeply influential to me in my own field of transnational labor law. And I want to stress the extent to which, of course, the work on pluralism has been critical to thinking about new sites of governance beyond the state, the codes of conduct, the range of actors beyond the domestic context. And so much of the work looking at legal pluralism has focused on those and their decentering of the state. But what Rod's work has allowed me to accept and to look more closely at is the extent to which the informal, the local, so in domestic work, the law in the home workplace, is equally deserving of attention, deserving of inquiry, deserving of consideration in terms of the quality of those relationships, and frankly, the centrality of those actors on the bottom being taken into consideration when they interact with and indeed create law. So thank you.
Do I see anybody that... oui, John.
What I want to say is that procedure in procedural fairness that matters may not be the procedure of representation and voice in deliberative processes, but the procedure of overcoming exclusion. You just said that, he said it, you said it. I'm surrounded by people who said it. Why say it again? Well, I'm trying to make a perfect square over here, a kind of left-wing square. The procedure, not of the process of deciding, but the procedure of being in the procedure, is such a challenge. It is something that we know exists, the exclusion of humanity, of dignity. We slaughter each other, at least in Aleppo and Mogadishu, and maybe here. We fail so often to grasp the dignity that everyone has, and fail to grasp the processes that say you are a person of dignity. I don't know what the answer to that is. There's so much meanness. There's an immigration judge, apparently, who thinks that if he's not overturned by the federal court, he has done his job, when in fact what he has done is deny the dignity of people who have come to tell him, was it him? Their stories of risk, of fear, of oppression. It's a horrible denial of the dignity of a person. It's evil, and it turns out to be Canadian. I think that we don't, we shouldn't focus, and that's why I like these, this trio here. We don't need to focus on how we do it. We need to focus on how it is that people actually get into the process, actually get even there, how it is they make an impact on the decision-making of other people, that their condition is actually worth considering.
I think we, this is a great leeway, I think, in we were invited if we wanted to make some final comments before we go. And I, listening to the conversations, it reminded me of a couple things that happened at the Law Commission where I knew Rod Moore. Who is missing in the consultation was often the question. And I think that in a way that's the maybe the questions that we are asking ourselves today too. Who is missing here? Certainly I think we have the representative of the students. We have some bureaucrats, not enough obviously, you know, there's a couple of people that should be here to hear this, but we probably want to enlarge a conversation about how many more people should hear about what's, what are the 27 ways in which keep off the grass is wrong. So il y a une, un développement de la conversation qui doit se, se passer en, de, en dehors de cette salle et d'une certaine façon ça va nous incomber à tous et à toutes là, de, d'élargir la conversation plus tard. I just wanted to say as well, I think we were challenged to ask whether there is a human rights to human agency. And I think this is, it's fun to think about the ways in which many of the insights translate into actions. You know, I think we all are talking about the way it has translated into our teaching and to our scholarships. But also I think it has changed because if you have watched Rod in action, it always challenges to act, to be true to yourself and to be transparent. So get off the duff and do something, you know, like, so there was a certain amount of being propelled to action in trying to mobilize, create new networks, being creative and reaching out, you know, to create the abilities for people to actually participate more. Il me semble qu'il y a beaucoup, d'autres personnes qui, qui voudront probablement prendre cette, cette idée de how we move the conversation outside of here. But yesterday on email I sent to my colleagues taking a little bit on Harry's thing. My question to them was, do you think Rod's an optimist or a pessimist? Optimist about the human race, but a pessimist about law? Or, and they all said, well, I've prepared something else. You're, you know, you haven't followed the instruction. So I said, but okay. So, but I will recidive it. It's, and my view is that it was inspiring to be with somebody that had both optimism about the potentiality of human action, but at the same time, a certain dose of realism and good wisdom about how, at times, it's very useful to be a pessimist. Any comments on that?
You're determined that we answer that one now, are you? I would say an optimist with an eye at all times on the pathological case, on the, an eye at all times on how things can be debased and where it can go wrong. And I was just sort of jotting down some thoughts here in response to a couple of the comments in how, in what's so wonderful and difficult about working with Rod's thought is how he puts what seem to be juxtaposed ideas together and yet shows their compatibility. So we have a real reverence for distinctiveness, you know, certain things do certain things in a certain way. And then we have an interest in variety and imagination that goes alongside distinctiveness. And then, of course, we have a thread that never, ever gets severed towards integrity. And so optimist, yes, but someone more deeply grounded in his thought with concerns of integrity is, I think, where I would place him, with an eye on what can go wrong. That's the pessimist.
Oh, I'm
not going to really add much to that, except for I would say he's an optimist about law if you take his notion of what law is. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
It depends on what you're talking about if you're talking about law. That's probably the biggest thing that I've learned from him as well.
Well, I was going to say that I actually think for students who come into the study of law, for some of us who started off in the study of law, really affected and drawn to the notion and promise of human rights, to thinking about power dynamics, the difficulties of individual empowerment, that in some ways the first meeting with Rod's insights and work is a little disheartening. And Rod can be quite sharp and almost dismissive about human rights talk, right? And so I think as I was listening and putting together some of the comments and the questioning about where is power in Rod's work, I actually think it's everywhere, but it's a reminder that individuals, and I often see this in students, right, can lose their own aspiration and capacities because of what they hear about repeated assertions about power dynamics, about where they can go, about what they can do. And I think in that sense, Rod's insistence that that we unpack those assertions, that we look at the fictions behind them, that we trust in ourselves, that we care about the face-to-face, the importance of mentorship, the importance of dreams, all of that is magical reality, but it's also very, very true. On the human rights stuff, I think about the uniform, and I think Edmund's right to remind us that the bow tie was supposed to be meant to kind of test a particular uniform. That's all very nice, except for those of us for whom the range of wardrobe is not all about men's suits, right? And whether you wear a long tie or a bow tie. And I think that that the influence of human rights has really been very, very significant for so many of us in ways that completely overlap with Rod MacDonald's insistence on human dignity, on inclusion, on integrity, on the questioning of uniform, the questioning of what many people often talk about as the limits of the human rights universe and the way in which we can understand claims. Personally, a lot of what I've taken from Rod's kind of interaction and scathing or challenging critique of some human rights work is the encouragement to look to places like schools, like workplaces, like neighborhoods for the kinds of interactions that many of us know, right, lie at the kind of roots of broad human rights instruments, and that the lived reality of that promise in those instruments is played out in those other sites.
I mean, obviously, the optimism and pessimism question is a very blunt question for a rich body of work that different people in the room read different ways. That's already apparent. And when it comes to pessimism, say about human rights or litigation, and Rod will ask who's excluded or how much does it cost or how does the system disadvantage some people more than others. But then there's an optimism, and I mean, Rod, of course, has this encyclopedic memory, and so the sort of range of examples that come to his mind is probably unlike the range of examples that would come to anyone else's mind in the room. And so you're trying to tell a little narrative about human rights in Canada, and maybe you reach back and consider, you know, the implied Bills of Rights cases in the 50s. And he says, but like, where's the abolition of seigneurial landholding in Quebec in the early 19th century? Like, that's a crucial human rights moment. That's a transformative moment. And so there's a sort of optimism. Different sources or different moments might be recognized as the ones in which even a strictly legal process increases the capacity for human agency or human freedom. Just before closing, I very diligently referred to the text earlier, but I had said that we could think of Rod as producing fairness in teaching in collegial moments. And I'm just going to share like a little microsecond from when I was a student, and it's a bit scary as a teacher, because you think, oh my God, like if people remember everything you say, it's a little bit paralyzing as a teacher, right? But I'm sitting in Rod's office, we're having a meeting, I'm a student at the time, the phone rings, and he says, Robert, excuse me for just a moment, I really have to pick this up. And he picks up the phone, and I don't know who it is, but he says, you know, so-and-so, I'm in a very important meeting with the editor-in-chief of the Law Journal. Can I call you back in 10 minutes? And I sort of, it hadn't occurred to me that I was in a very important meeting with Rod McDonald until that moment. But the ability, the respect I detected in that relationship, that he would say to someone else, you know, what I'm doing is important now, and I recognize you, and I have a relationship with you to maintain, and I'm going to finish this meeting, and I'll get back to you. That struck me as utterly, I realize now, utterly characteristic of Rod's way of being. But it wasn't the way that students are necessarily always treated in a law faculty or other settings.
But you know he had only 10 minutes, though.
Well, there was a message. There was a message. I mean, I now know the meeting is important, but we have 9 minutes left. But it's still, there's a kind of interactive micro-fairness that I think Rod embodies all the time. And I think I don't live up to it, but I think about it as I engage in the relationships that I have in the faculty, and I would like to thank Rod for that.
And I think in a way, everyone that has ever had an administrative position in universities is thanking Rod for his leadership in inventing deaning in a different way. So I think I probably speak to everyone who has ever had this, who had these moments where you say, yes, I've learned a lot about the way in which to be present and to be there for others. So, je pense que ça conclut pour ce matin. Merci beaucoup. Le lunch est servi plus tard. Okay, whatever. Merci beaucoup. Merci.